Okay, so we'll be continuing our exploration of different quantum phases of matter. So we've already seen like a symmetry breaking phase, interface transition. Yan-Chen also has talked about Chern insulator, quantum Hall states. And so this week we'll be talking about two new kinds of phases of matter, topological order and symmetry protected topological order. Okay. And those have been very relevant, especially in the past, well, several decades even. So the topic of this lecture will be topological order. And we'll also touch on some practical aspects of it, namely quantum memory. Okay. So, as you'll see, topological order is not only interesting from a physical point of view, it has many interesting properties, as we'll see, but these properties actually turn out to be possibly useful for quantum computing, for storing quantum information and even manipulating it. Okay, so this is one of the interesting interplays between many body physics and quantum information. Okay, so let me just give you a rough picture of the things we expect to see from topological order, some very universal features of such non-trivial phases. So first, as you'll see, this is a distinct phase of matter. Compared to a trivial product state, for example. And this is true regardless of any symmetry. Right, so if you recall, at the beginning of this course, we saw these symmetry breaking phases with GHZ type order, for example. But as we emphasized near the end of this lectures, calling that a distinct phase of matter actually requires demanding the presence of a global Ising or spin flip symmetry. Without that symmetry, there is no distinct phase of matter. The GHZ or the symmetry breaking states are actually connected to product states with a finite depth unitary. But here, as we'll see, the topological order, it doesn't require making any symmetry assumption. It really is like a intrinsically different phase of matter. Okay, so that's one point. And another point is that there's no local order parameter. That can be used to distinguish topological order from trivial order, right? So again, if we compare to the symmetry breaking states, there, at least for like all up, all down, there's a local magnetic moment that you can measure that tells you are you in a symmetry broken phase, right? Or alternatively, if you want to stick with the GHZ basis, there are long range correlations that tell you you're non-trivial, like these connected ZZ correlations are long range in GHZ. So those tell you they're non-trivial. However, as you'll see, for these topologically ordered ground states, there's no such local diagnostic or even local long range correlations that tell you you're topologically ordered or not. So it's much more subtle, and in fact, we're going to be looking at different aspects of these states that tell you that it's non-trivial. Okay. So one such signature, like positive signature of topological order, is that the number of ground states in a topologically ordered system actually depends on the topology of the manifold that you're defining the model on. Okay. So So this is one of several reasons why this is called topological order, but clearly this is quite exotic. And again, for symmetry breaking states, this is not the case, right? No matter where you put the Ising model on, you get two GHZ states. Okay. So that's this is one more, I guess, mathematically appealing aspect of topological order. One very physically interesting aspect is the existence of anion excitations. So, you know, as y'all know, we're usually taught that particles can only be bosons or fermions, but yet in these, at least in these lower dimensional or 2D systems, we can actually have these emergent quasi-particle-like excitations that are kind of between bosons and fermions. So we'll see these excitations explicitly probably in the lecture tomorrow. Okay, and finally, we'll also touch on the entanglement structure of these states. How can we tell that it's non-trivial just by looking at entanglement properties of the ground state wave functions? Okay, so this is the plan. So these are the salient properties that we'll be covering. And as we did for the transistorizing model, where we worked out an explicit model, here again, we'll start with the workhorse of topological order, which is Kitaev's Torr code model. Okay. So let me, so again, I apologize if some of you have already seen this model. I just want to just cover the central definitions. So again, if you've seen it, you can feel free to think about other things. So let's define this model, Z2 Torr code. Actually, I noticed that most of you are sitting on that side, so I don't know why I'm writing all this here. Maybe I should just go with the crowd, right? Okay, so let's define the Z2 Torr code in two dimensions. And as is the case with much of modern quantum matter, this model is due to Kitaev around 2003. Okay, so the model is defined on a square lattice. And on every square lattice, we have on every link of the square lattice, we have a qubit. So each dot here denotes a qubit or spin 1/2 of your freedom on each edge or link. And the Hamiltonian, again, consists of two pieces. So the first piece is a sum over all stars on the square lattice, where this operator A is the product of Pauli Zs around the star. So Z, 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 Z. Again, I'm using Z as shorthand for sigma Z, the Pauli Z operator. And the other term is summation over plaquettes. So here the plaquette operators is defined as product of Pauli X around every plaquette. Okay, and so this is an example of what's called a stabilizer Hamiltonian. So stabilizers are basically strings of Pauli operators, like, you know, the product of Z's, product of X's. And most importantly, all the stabilizers commute with each other. Okay, so we can check that. Okay, so all the star operators manifestly commute with each other. They all involve Z's, right? Z's always commute with Z's. And similarly, the placket operators are all made out of X's, so they also commute. This is all zero. And slightly more non-trivially, the stars and plaquettes also commute with each other. So if one takes a star and a plaquette somewhere else and they're disjoint, then clearly they commute. However, even if they are adjacent, for example, if you take this star and this plaquette right here, they intersect at two qubits, this one and this one, but because there are an even number of shared qubits, the fact that X and Z anti-commute, the minus one factor you get from anti-commutation squares the one because you have two qubits. Okay, so you can check that even if the star and plaquette are adjacent, they also commute. Okay, so when everything commutes, at least at the operator level, it's fairly simple to write down the ground state of the Hamiltonian. So the ground state is just given by all these operators taking value one, right, to minimize the energy. So all the stars, all the plaquettes should take value one. Okay, so that's a good first step toward solving for the ground state of this model. But what does this actually, what does this actually mean for a picture of the wave function? So, to answer that question, we can consider a general wave function that's written as some superposition of states. Superposition of basically configurations in the Z basis, let's say. Okay, so we work in the Z or the computational basis, and we label, so we consider a complete set of states. They're just all spin configurations in the Z basis. Right? So each SI is plus or minus one, and we can, we might also call this up, down. Okay, so this is the most general form of, you know, a wave function, right? But then what is this, what are these operators being set to one? What do they mean for, you know, constraining this wave function? So, first of all, let's see what the AS equals one means. Okay. So AS equals one means that in this representation, the spin configuration must be a loop configuration. Right, so basically AS equals one means that for every star, if I have all the spins around the star, then their product must be one, right? So this means that there must be an even number of spin downs for every vertex. Okay. So for example, we can have no spin downs at all. We can have all spin downs. We can have an even number of spin downs. Yeah, so basically this puts this parity constraint on the number of spin downs at every vertex. And so now I can just draw configurations that satisfy these constraints, right? So you can see that when I enforce even number of spin downs, that's basically just enforcing that the minus ones or the spin downs form loops, right? So here, the squiggly line means presence of a minus one. And if there's no squiggly line, that means SI is plus one. So a valid configuration enforced by S equals one is just some loop configuration. Okay, so this is what AS equals one enforces. It means that my ground state now has slightly more structure. It's a sum over loops. Superposition of loop configurations. Okay. And now the question is what is the role of the other operator being set to one? So now BP equals one. So let's understand the effect of this BP operator on the basis of loop configurations, right? So BP equals one means that I want.
Tim.
Yeah.
Do you mean when for that one? Do we have it like that? Every loop has an even number of odd spins throughout the entire lattice. Like that's what we're trying to emphasize, or.
The constraint is that every vertex has an even number of strands, right, or minus ones coming out of it. Right?
Okay.
So that enforces that we're only allowed to superpose loop configuration.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the constrained Hilbert space we're working in, and now we're trying to see what the effect of BP equals one is, and so. You can convince yourself that BP, acting on this Hilbert space of loops, just tries to fluctuate the loops. So what do I mean by that? So if you have BP acting on, say, some loop vacuum, so just no loops at all, then this can create a loop, right? Right, so if you take BP, which, again, is some product of X, then it'll, you know, hit this plaquette, it'll flip everything from one to minus one, so it'll create a small loop, right? And similarly, it can also, if you already have a loop there, it can destroy the loop, right? And it can also just move the, it can also stretch loops too, right? So if you have some loop here, and then P is like a neighboring plaquette, then, the product of X will hit here, and it'll just make this bigger, right? Okay, so BP is basically just mapping one loop configuration to another loop configuration by distorting the strands, right? Okay, so what BP equals one, how it constrains the wave function is to basically demand that the ground state wave function is an equal weight superposition of all loop configurations. Okay, so what it does is it constrains this coefficient psi of SI to all be one. Okay. That way, BP acting on psi ground state equals itself, right? You're already summing over all the configurations, so B BP just maps one to another, and so they're all, so you just get a phase plus one, no phase factor. Okay, so alternatively, but equivalently, you can also derive this fact maybe slightly easier. So one can actually build the ground state wave function by just projecting onto the space in which all the Plaquette operators are one, acting on some reference state that's just the all up state. Okay. So why is this a valid ground state of Tory code? Well, let's first check the star operator. So remember that the star operator is a product of z's, and the z's commute with the bp's, and the z's acting on this reference all up state is clearly one, right? Because when everything is up, product of them is one. And so as equals one, right? And then furthermore, by construction, we're multiplying this with all the projectors onto BP being one. So that's by definition. Okay. So this indeed is a ground state of the model. And now maybe it's slightly more manifest that you can just expand this into basically a superposition of all possible binary strings on Plaquettes. Basically all possible ways of hitting this state with the BP operators. Hitting this reference no loop state with all possible combinations of BP. And so this is indeed, as we indicated before, a sum over all loops. Okay. Okay, but in this case, maybe it's slightly more manifest that here we're summing over all contractible loops. Okay. When we use these sequences of BPs to hit this reference state, we're just creating, loops like these, right? There's no way we can create like a loop that winds around globally, right? So, okay, this point will become slightly clearer in a little bit, but you can convince yourself that we hit the state with all the BPs, we get contractible loops. Are there any questions so far on this? Okay, so this relatively benign looking AS equals BP equals plus one condition translates into a very interesting structure of this wave function. We have a wave function that's a superposition of all loop configurations, right? And so this is yet another sense in which maybe topological and topological order is justified, right? Okay, so now let's look at one of the properties I mentioned, which is this ground state degeneracy depending on what manifold that the model is placed on. Okay, so now let's discuss ground state degeneracy. So let's first consider placing this model on a torus. Okay, so just using periodic boundary conditions. Right? So I have a square lattice. square lattice. So then I identify, say, these with these. And let's say these with these. Okay. So this Hamiltonian is defined on a square lattice with periodic boundary conditions on both sides. And then the question is, how many different ground states are there? Okay. So we found one of them, but it may not be unique, right? So so basically we can calculate how many ground states there are by just starting out with how many degrees of freedom there are originally, and then how many constraints did I impose on the ground state, right? So the number of spins, the number of total spins is 2L squared, right? Every link. Yeah, sorry. So the square lattice is a L by L square lattice. And the number of ground states is just the full Hilbert space divided by the number of constraints, right? So these are the constraints. So let's check how many constraints have we imposed on this ground state. So all our constraints are coming from these star and plaquette terms, right? These are the constraints. So the number of star constraints is, okay, so how many stars are there? There are L squared stars for an L by L lattice, right? So they're L squared. However, not all of them are independent. So there's a global constraint on these constraints. So basically the product of all star operators is one, right? If I multiply all, yeah, if I multiply every star, then each link is hit twice by z's coming from each star. So if I multiply all of them, I get identity operator. So not all the constraints are independent, right? So only L squared minus one of these are independent. Okay. And similarly, if I look at the plaquette, then I also have L squared plaquettes, but again, only L squared minus one are independent for a similar reason. If I multiply all the plaquettes, then each link is hit by an X operator twice, so that multiplies the identity. Okay, so that means that this is 2 to the 2L squared minus L squared minus 1 minus L squared minus 1. And this leaves actually a fourfold degeneracy. Okay. So we found one ground state earlier, the superposition of contractible loops. So now, what about the other three states? What do those look like? Is this clear? Any questions on this?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Is related to the topology of this two-dimensional
torus. Yeah, so, yeah, indeed, I realized I advertised this dependence on the genus of the manifold. I just remember that I didn't plan on covering that in this lecture yet. So here I'm just focusing on the torus with genus one, right? But one can play the similar constraint matching, you know, Hilbert space calculation, Hilbert space minus number of constraints on different manifolds, and you'll see that the way the constraints, you know, can multiply the identity here changes depending on boundary conditions or the way the manifold is defined. So I
related to the genus, because here the genus is one. So
yes, right.
The direct relationship, at least.
Yeah. There is a direct relationship, but I probably shouldn't have advertised that there. So let's focus on the torus here. Maybe next lecture I can discuss the depends on the genus if there's interest. Right? But you can kind of see that the way the calculation works out is looking at how many constraints are redundant, right? And so here with periodic boundary condition, they all multiply in a certain way to the identity, right? Depending on how the whole space is connected, right? But on a different manifold, you know, that this part will be different. Yeah, I think it's a good thing to see. Maybe a good homework problem too. Yeah. Okay, so let's focus on the torus for now, in which we derive that there's a fourfold degeneracy, and let's see what are the other three states. Okay. So let's first just call the ground state that we found, which is a superposition of all contractible loops C. I think I mixed up the node. Yeah, so let's first call the superposition of all contractible loops 0, 0. And what this notation means is that if I ask, are there any loops that wind around the x direction or the y direction, then they're zero, or the parity of the loops winding around the x and the y direction is zero. Okay, this is basically the definition of contractible. All the snapshots of the loops, you can shrink them down. You can shrink them down to points. Right. An example of a non-contractible loop. Example of a non-contractible loop is one that winds around, say, a cycle of the torus. Right? This would be a non-contractible loop. Yeah, let me just maybe explicitly write this. So this is non-contractible. If it winds around, if it just goes like this, then it's contractible. Okay, so here this 0, 0 denotes that none of the loops in this big superposition are winding around the torus. Okay, so this is a ground state. So what about the three remaining ones? So to find the remaining ones, we can define some new operators that are important. So let's define them here. So let's define a product of x operators that are winding, say, around the x direction. Let's define this to be wx. And let's define similarly.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I think I just missed it. Can you explain again the y hat in the circles in the state?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm calling. Okay. So this will, the reason why we're using this notation will make more sense shortly, But right now, it just denotes the fact that in every loop configuration here, no loop winds around the torus an odd number of times.
That's supposed to represent a circle, right? Not a zero? Or is that supposed to represent a zero?
Yeah, it's supposed to represent zero. Zero, right? Yeah. Yeah, so first, so we're trying to understand the remaining three ground states, and it's useful to define these string operators. Okay, these are extended operators, like product of x along one direction, and product of x around another direction, say the y direction. This is called wy. Okay, so notice that wx and wx, wy, they commute with all the terms in the Hamiltonian. Right, so they clearly commute with all the BPs. BPs are made out of X's. And they commute with all the star terms too, because if a star term overlaps with this, for example, like Z, 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 then again there are an even number of qubits that are touched by both the string and the star, so the minus ones cancel. Okay. So these commute with all the terms in the Hamiltonian. And this means that we can apply these operators now to this reference state to get the other three ground states. Okay. So let's define the 1-0 state to mean wx applied to the 0-0 reference state. So now this equals a superposition of all loops, but now every loop in the superposition winds around the torus. An odd number of times. Okay. So basically, 0-0 consisted of things that look like, contractible loops. But then now, when I hit it with this x string, right, then I will now I will flip a long string winding around this direction. So the total winding number of this loop configuration will now be 1, right? Yeah, but here, in general, it's an odd number of times because, if I use the BP operator and I guess this one might have been, maybe a little bit misleading because here I can hit the reference state with a string of BP operators, right? And the BP operators will actually create two such strings of X operators, right? So actually this one also includes things like things with an even number of windings around the X cycle. Okay. So this is why at the end of the day it's only the parity of the winding that distinguishes these different states.
Wait, sorry, can you repeat the even?
So remember that this 0-0 state was obtained by hitting the all up state by all possible sequences of BP buckets, right? However, so I have some reference configuration. But then if I hit this state with, you know, BP here, BP here, BP here, BP here, BP here, then all these vertical links are hit twice, so nothing happens. But then now this flips this to all minus one, this all to minus one. Right. This is why only the parity of the winding distinguishes the different sectors. Like even or odd here.
And ultimately, is it just because they're this like the fact that there are two terms that anti-commute in these things? Like you can't undo just one thing.
Yeah, that's right. Ultimately, it's because, let's say, you know, naively, you might want to try to apply this operator more to get different states, right? You might want to apply it twice, right? Like WX here, WX here. But that turns out to be already a product of the local stabilizers, right? So that product is not independent of the local stabilizers, right? So only like an odd number of strings is independent from the group of operators generated by AS and BP. Okay, so that's one other state, and and it's not too hard to guess the remaining ones.
Did you call W operators the string operators?
You can call it a string operator. Later, as you can see, people call it a logical operator. And you'll see why shortly. It's just some non-local operator. And non-local is important here, as we'll also see. Okay, so similarly, we can define other ground states. 0, 1 is obtained by applying the WY operator on the reference 0, 0 ground state. And obviously, 1, 1 is WX, WY on 0, 0. Okay, so we've enumerated all four ground states of this toric code Hamiltonian defined on a torus, and they're characterized by their different winding numbers around the torus cycles. Okay, so I'll point out two important properties of these ground states, which is just essential defining feature of topological order. So one feature is that all ground states are locally indistinguishable. So this means that let me now just label these ground states by A, B, and then A, B is just WX to the A, WY to the B, acting on 0, 0. So here A, B is either 0, 1. So this is how I'm labeling these four ground states. And locally indistinguishable, what I mean by that is that if I take any local operator, any local operator O, then the expectation value in any of these ground states are all the same. Okay, they're all exactly the same as if I took the expectation value in this reference ground state. Okay, and the reason why this is true is one can compute the reduced density matrix for all of these ground states, right? So remember that the whole purpose of the reduced density matrix is to reproduce all expectation values of operators supported on that region, right? So if I partition a ground state into a region A and its complement, right? And then I look at the reduced density matrix, which is defined by tracing out its complement from the global state AB. Then this is actually independent of which ground state I chose. Okay, like no matter whether AB is 0 or 1, the reduced density matrix is the same for all four ground states. And specifically, it's just, one can compute this explicitly, it's just a product of all the constraints, the product of all these star and Plaquette constraints for stars and Plaquettes inside the region A. Okay. So basically, the reduced density matrix on A doesn't know about the global winding around the torus. So it looks the same for all four ground states. And this means that all local operators supported only on A, cannot tell the difference. They don't know the difference between these four different states. Okay. So at this point, it's useful to, again, compare to the GHZ or symmetry breaking states, you know, we discussed at the beginning. So let's just briefly compare to GHZ. So remember, GHZ plus or minus was all up, plus or minus, all down. And so these two GHZ, GHZ plus or GHZ minus, they also cannot be distinguished by local operators, right? If I look at a reduced density matrix for GHZ, then it looks the same for these two cat states. Okay. However, the difference here is that there exists a way to the difference here is that GHZ plus and GHZ minus, they span a space in which there are two locally distinguishable basis states, right? So of course, 0 and 1 are locally distinguishable. Right. So the ground state space, you know, there exists a basis in which a ground state space is locally distinguishable. But for topological order, no choice of basis of this fourfold degenerate space is locally distinguishable. Okay. All of them have the same reduced density matrix. Okay. So that's again, harkens back to the fact that for topological order, we don't care about any, you know, imposing any symmetry or anything in defining it. Okay, so this local indistinguishability is a maybe even one defining feature of topological order. Okay, so now let me mention a different but closely connected property, which is yeah, I don't think we need this right now. Yeah, so the other important pretty much defining feature of topological order is that these ground states are not maybe heuristically called locally connectable. Okay, so in other words, if I consider, if I try to use a local operator, to transform one of these degenerate ground states into another one, so here AB is distinct from A prime B prime, then this matrix element is very close to zero. Okay. So it's a local operator cannot move one ground state to another one. So one way to see why this is true is the following. So let's say I did have some local operator, which could transform one ground state into another. Then if I look at a linear combination of these two states, then this local operator could distinguish these two different linear combinations. So if this were true, then O could distinguish or take different values in these two different linear combinations, right? But we know that all states in this ground state manifold are locally indistinguishable. Okay. So this is why this properties 1 and 2 are closely tied to one another. Okay. These ground states, they cannot be locally distinguished. They can also not be locally related to each other. Okay. So this is why the ground states, yeah, sorry, I should pause. Right, yeah.
This part again, I don't understand.
What's the option of O on side 2? Yeah, that's a good question. I think I want to assume that O is at least Hermitian. Okay, so if I just take an expectation value in this state of O, then I get O1 okay, but yeah, maybe I am making some additional assumptions here, so let's see. Okay, so this part is the same, then I just have a minus sign here. Right? These are the two different expectation values, right? So, I guess I want this part to be non-zero to distinguish them. So maybe I'm placing some constraints on O, but okay, this is like a maybe a too rough justification, but you can see how the 1 and 2 are related by this, right? Yeah. Yeah, any other questions on this? Okay, so so these properties 1 and 2 are one of the reasons why these four states, or the ground state degeneracy of Torah code, is useful for using Torah code as a quantum error correcting code, right? So the idea is that we want to encode some quantum information into these four ground states, right? So say we have a 2-qubit state, right? So I have 2 qubits, and I consider a most general state 0, 0. One, zero, one, one. Then the idea is that I want to encode this wave function into these four degenerate states. Okay, so I replace these by their corresponding ground state of this model. Yeah, sorry. Okay, so this is some encoding of this 2-qubit state into the ground state manifold of the Torah code. And the reason why this is promising is because precisely of these properties. So if I have like some environment that's trying to corrupt the system, usually noise acts locally. But if I use local operators, I can neither learn about any information about which sector I'm in by local operator, and I cannot corrupt the information by moving between different states, right? So like an environment which you might be modeled by the action of a local operator cannot move around this ground state manifold, and it cannot learn about the state. Okay.
Does this somehow extend to like thermal noise as
well? Okay, so yeah, that's a very good question. That's right. So finite temperature is actually a pretty long story, and in the case of 2D Torah code, it doesn't extend to finite temperature. So actually, it's like finite temperature is qualitatively different than the type of perturbations that we'll discuss at Torah code. So along with the whole theme of the course, we'll talk about zero temperature quantum phase and transitions. But yeah, finite temperature is a subtle question. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, like I guess in the next lecture we'll continue deriving some properties of Torah code, the non-trivial anion excitations, robustness of this degeneracy, and entanglement structure. Okay. So sorry, I apologize if this last part was a little bit rushed, but you can feel free to ask. Yeah.
Can you maybe just go through the discussion again on like what the arrow means, like with the 2-qubit state part?
I haven't really shown you how this encoding works in practice, right? But one can imagine like if you had 2 physical qubits in this particular state, that state would be quite susceptible to noise, right? Like if something just comes in and measures Z or X operator, it might destroy some information here. But if there's some way of encoding it so that these four states are not simple two-qubit states, but many-body ground states of the type we just enumerated, then this state is now more robust to noise precisely because of properties one and two.
Right.
So now if a local operator comes in, then it cannot even distinguish which state it is.
Right.
In contrast to say like a operator here, right?
I see.
Yeah.
So it's like, I guess, a way of having a more robust qubit.
Yeah. I just want to motivate why these two, you know, defining properties of topological order, you know, make it potentially useful as a good code or a good way of storing quantum information. Yeah. Yeah, any other questions?
This is not probably related to this lecture, but is this the like third property, the number of ground states depends on topology? Does it also like work for SVTs?
For SVT, usually you have a unique ground state when you have closed boundary conditions. It's only when you have an open boundary condition that you have some degeneracy. And we'll get to that Thursday.